You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
Welcome to the ECF staff room. I'm Elaine Long.
And I am Mark Quinn.
We are programme leaders for the UCL Early Career Teacher Development Programme. Why are we in the staff room? We are here because this is where the best professional learning conversations always take place. This is where problems can be aired bluntly and where solutions can be explored.
Over the course of this series, we will hear the voices of different colleagues as they come into the ECF staff room. We will hear from early career teachers themselves and from the mentors and induction tutors who support them. We will talk about all things ECF, the challenges and the joys. So why don't you enjoy a coffee with us, perhaps even grab a biscuit and sit down to half an hour of ECF staff room chat. Welcome to the ECF staff room, Hayley Hughes. With all the projects you're juggling at the moment, including being a facilitator on the UCL ECF program, you must be well in need of a coffee. Is it coffee? Is that what you drink? Is that what we can offer you in the staff room?
Coffee, gin, a clandestine gin. Would that be allowed? I don't know.
I think that's probably against Teacher Standard 8. Hayley, I don't think I can give you gin.
They always get me on that one.
maybe an extra shot in the coffee. I can manage that.
That'd be lovely.
Do you take anything with your coffee? Is there a biscuit there or...?
Many biscuits. I think that's the problem. So in this run up to Christmas, all willpower has disappeared, sadly.
So the staff room cupboard is empty because you've eaten all the biscuits.
Indeed. Yeah.
Maybe we need to do a special Christmas edition that's ECF bar. And I would definitely join you in there for a gin and tonic, Hayley. That would really suit me. And Mark and I are really nosy, and we know our listeners are really nosy as well. And we know that you've had a really interesting career today. And we just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that. What did you do before teaching? Where did teaching take you? And what do you do now?
Absolutely, yeah. So as you kind of alluded to, I have had a long and winding road to get to the point that I'm at now. I think I must have some kind of, I don't know, revolutionist's blood or something inside me somewhere, because I can't really stick at anything for longer than about 10 years usually. So before I was a teacher, I was a national newspaper journalist, an infamous London tabloid newspaper that was closed down for phone hacking. Daresn't say the name. I had a great time there, did lots of things that I regret, lots of things that I thoroughly enjoyed, but it was a hell of an experience. So that's what I did. And then the newspaper was closing down, and I thought about the fact that I had an English degree and what on earth was I going to do with an English degree? So I thought, you know what, let's have a go at teaching. Spent some time in a school helping out in my old secondary school, actually, which was funny being in the staff room with all of my old teachers. Loved it. Absolutely thought, oh my God, this is what I was made to do. And then I taught for 15 and a half years. So that's what I did then. Very quickly moved into leadership, found out it wasn't really for me. I missed the day-to-day classroom teacher job of really making a difference and getting to know children. Missed my own subject a lot of English as well. And I feel like there's a constant, and perhaps this is something I'll touch on later, but I feel like when you go into leadership, there's like a constant battle almost to actually be a good teacher as well as an effective leader. Because, you know, I used to find myself kind of setting the children off on independent tasks and getting time to check my emails and being more interested in my emails and what was coming through than actually my pedagogy. And I hated that. So I stepped back down, so to speak, to just, and I hate that phrase, just a classroom teacher, because you are never just a classroom teacher, for the last 9 years of my career, and adored it, absolutely loved it. And then I wrote a couple of books, one of them being Mentoring in Schools, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. had the opportunity to go and do lots of things that I'd probably only dreamed of, to be honest. You know, speaking all over Europe in schools, working with lots of colleagues in HE. And then I joined Iris Connect as head of education and also the University of Sunderland, initially as a PGC English lecturer, but very quickly became principal lecturer in mentoring and professional development. And this is where I am now, with two careers that are separate but intersect on many, many different ways, and consultancy on top of that as well.
That sounds like a really, really interesting road you've taken. And I know you're really passionate about writing. And one of the things that comes across in all your interviews and your writing is you're really passionate about making a difference. And I read Yes. recently that your PhD is focused on children that are left behind, and that you're very passionate that we don't leave children behind in education. I wonder if you could just tell the listeners a bit about that.
Yeah, so that wasn't my PhD, that was my last master's degree. Okay. So yeah, my EdD is actually based on the effect of the COVID-19 school closures on experienced teachers, which has been really interesting. But no, you're absolutely right. My last master's degree that I did, my psychology one, was all about that. And yeah, it's just because the background I came from, I was the first person to go to school post 16 in my family. Mum's a cleaner, stepdad's a lorry driver. And, you know, I really struggled with my own identity during school time. Very often, I think it was a misrepresentation, really, of kind of Bourdieu's work on cultural capital, whereby I grew up thinking that my background wasn't good enough. That, you know, I had to be ashamed of where I came from. I had to be ashamed of the fact that we didn't have books in my house. And when I moved to London at the really young age of 21, I really tried to divorce myself. I've written about this on my blog, you know, really tried to divorce myself from my own background. And a lot of the time at school, I spent being quite angry and misbehaving and not getting on with teachers. And it was very much because of this liminal space that I felt like I existed in and still do exist in, to be honest. I feel so. Yeah, I mean, it's something I'm really passionate about, is this idea about kind of not letting disadvantage be a barrier for our children.
And I'm just sort of thinking about our listeners, if your younger self could go back and give your teachers a message, what would your younger self kind of say?
Oh, God, I don't know, really. I mean, some of them follow me on Twitter, which is like absolutely hilarious. So I'll get kind of periodic messages from some of them who are sort of retiring now, or lots of them are head teachers, saying how proud they are of me, which is just lovely. And, you know, one of my teachers who was at the time Mrs. Brettel, who is a geography teacher and is now a Pru head teacher, like amazing woman. She quite often posts on my Twitter saying, you know, I remember a quite angry, mouthy teenager that has turned out to be, you know, a reasonable human being. And so yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say, sorry guys, you know, I've turned out all right in the end, I hope.
Yeah, and I guess that there's a lesson there, isn't there, for the ECTs and teachers in terms of seeing the best in people and recognising what might be going on underneath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly that, really. And I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of arguing and toing and froing that goes on Twitter and all the tribalism that comes with it about, you know, trauma-informed practices, etc. And I'm not going to get into that debate, actually. But what I would say is that there can very often be some kind of underlying cause for challenging behaviour. Not always, but there can be. And I think it's important that we as teachers recognise that.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, just remember, there's always a story behind the face, behind the person who turns up in your classroom.
Yes.
And it's tough, isn't it, being a teacher? You know, you might be, especially if you're teaching secondary and you've got hundreds of children and you don't, you know, in any single day, and you can't possibly know every story behind them. But at least if you've got that in your, you know, in your imagination, if you're a teacher, you can imagine that there might be something going on. It's not just the student being naughty or hating your subject, or, you know, there might be other things. And it's usually not personal as well. If they're acting out in your class, it's not really about you, or not about you as a person. Although, of course, it feels like that as a teacher, doesn't it?
Oh, God,
because
so much.
You invest so much in it as a teacher, of your personality, everything feels personal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we sometimes forget is that, you know, a lot of young people in secondary, especially, you know, the hormones are raging and, you know, they can't really modulate and control the feelings in the same way that we can as an adult. And it's absolutely not personal. Although, my goodness, after a tough week, you know, with a year nine class for 2 hours on a Friday, it might seem that way. So this is why teaching is such a roller coaster job, isn't it?
That's right. And of course, there's nothing funnier than a year nine class last thing on a Friday as well.
Absolutely. I still chuckle when I think of some of the things that they say. You know, there are kids who are literally like stand-up comedians. It's brilliant.
Hayley, you mentioned the book. You mentioned your Mentoring in Schools book, which I have in front of me. And I've been doing my homework by rereading it this week. It's really obvious that you've got a passion about mentoring. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the main reason, or one of the reasons why we've invited you into the staff room today. And I noticed that in the construction of your book, you convened a focus group of ECTs mm-hmm. to tell you what they think makes a good mentor. And it's really, really interesting, isn't it? What they say, mm-hmm. they say things that they want their mentor to be impartial and mm-hmm. approachable and passionate and to remember what it was like when they were a new teacher. I particularly liked the ECT who said that they wanted their mentor to be a mini cheerleader. That's a nice one. So with all of that, I mean, how do you define what a great mentor does or what a great mentor is?
I would say that a good mentor has got kind of two distinct skill sets, I would say. There's sort of the soft skills, which are, you know, some of the things that you mentioned about being a cheerleader, being empathetic, you know, building trust, being able to be an active listener and to really listen. Because I think sometimes when you've been teaching a long time, you sort of might half listen and you're thinking about something else in the other side of your brain at the same time. Or if you're me, thinking about what you're having for dinner, or, you know, you're going to be binging Harry and Meghan on Netflix or whatever later, you know. But you know, you really have to listen and then to not interrupt. And, you know, all of these things, setting granular targets, all of these things that, you know, the bread and butter, I would call, of mentoring, all the soft skills. But then we also now, especially with the launching of the early career framework last year and the core content framework the year before. Oh, there's dogs in my office, which is what you can hear. So sorry about that.
We call it the school. It's the school dog. We just call it the school dog.
Yeah, there's Iris Connect. It's a very dog friendly place to work. So there's several running around. But I would say that there's that other subset as well. And there's that job around, pedagogy. And I would say that for me, like, mentors are more facilitators of pedagogical progress than they've ever been before. So, you know, when I was a mentor for many, many years, for example, and I look back on the way that I mentored now, and would I pass muster as kind of a perfect mentor today by today's standards? Possibly not, because I didn't do as much modeling as I probably could. I didn't triangulate with research. Was I completely conversant with all of the evidence base underpinning the ECF and the CCF? Probably not. So I think mentors have a huge job on their hands now. And I think, you know, obviously the DfE recognised that when they were trying to elevate the status of mentors. And that's why we have this compulsory mentor training that comes as part of programmes like your own.
That's really, really interesting, isn't it? I'm delighted that you drew attention to those two aspects of mentoring. I think the first aspect of mentoring we're very familiar with. Yes. And actually, we're familiar with it, but that doesn't make it easy. No. And not everyone wants to be that kind of person, wants to be that in-tune type of person, that sounding board person, that's the person with those soft skills, as you talked about. That's tough enough, actually.
It is.
But of course, we've now made the job even harder, haven't we? You know, by saying, oh, you've got to keep in mind this curriculum as well, and you've got to talk about evidence-informed or ECF-informed practice, and that is tough. It's really tough. It proves, doesn't it, that mentoring really does matter, doesn't it?
Yes.
Would you say anything more about that? Why you think mentoring matters so much?
Yeah,
that's also the name of your magazine. So you've got.
Yeah. Oh, nice plug. I like that. Yeah. yes. So I'll talk about the magazine in a second. But absolutely. I mean, I think like many who were trained in a certain time period, I finished my training year, my IT year, and I was pretty much left to sink or swim, to be honest. I had a mentor who had a lot of the soft skills, although I hate that name for them because they're obviously not soft skills because they're really important, they're the bedrock. But you know what I'm trying to get across. I had a mentor who was actually really good at a lot of those things, but when it came to the kind of other part, that sort of theory into practice, the bridging piece, what maybe wasn't as good. And because of that, I was left kind of floundering. I learned a lot of things in my IT year, some of which have now been debunked, but hey, that's the case with all research. We'll be saying the same things, I'm sure, about things we're doing now in 20 years' time. I'd left with a lot of ideas about research, but I had no idea about what the implications for that research were in my classroom. You know, I needed somebody there to show me, hey, you learnt about Socratic questioning. Well, actually, this is what Socratic questioning looks like in English. With a year nine class on a Friday afternoon, you know, I can give you analogies, I can give you metaphors from my own practice. And that for me is how mentors are important, because mentors are the bridge between theory and practice. They're the ones who are deconstructing, discussing expert practice, you know, contextualizing it, modeling it, practicing it with you. And that's why for me, they're vital. They're kind of like the scaffold, if you like, for a new teacher to walk alongside.
And it's interesting as well, because you gave the example of a English example being subject specific. So yes. I think mentors are also that bridge between generic pedagogy and subject specific pedagogy as well. I agree with you, they play such a vital role. And the tension that you picked up on between being a mentor that teaches the curriculum and being a mentor that also helps an ECT as an individual to progress those sort of softer skills. I think that's something that mentors on our program find hard, because we recognize that tension in some of the feedback. Have you got any advice for how people can balance that, or how mentors can balance that in schools?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult, and especially when, unfortunately, I still hear that some mentors aren't being given the time to mentor appropriately. And, you know, I think that's something that a lot of teaching school hubs are really struggling with, because what do you do? Where do you go from there? You know, they don't have this sort of legislative role where they can say, like, actually, no, you are breaking the law, that you need to do this. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I sympathise with schools entirely. They've got a huge number of staff off absent at the moment. It's never really recovered from COVID. A lot of heads can't recruit. They're struggling for budgets. Like, I get it 100%, not pointing fingers at anybody, but really for mentors to be able to do exactly what you talked about, Elaine, with fidelity, they need that time to be able to do that. I think as you kind of touched on, obviously the ECF is generic pedagogy, and it has to be, because I mean, it would be like Tolstoy, wouldn't it, if it was subject specific? You know, it's we'd be wedging the door open with it. So that is where a mentor skill comes in, really, to be able to actually, it's that curse of the expert, to be able to step back from your own practice and go, well, actually, how does that translate into my lessons in English? You know, how does that translate to my lessons in EYFS? And obviously this is something that has come under scrutiny about the ECF, about its generic nature. And I think now, only a year into the proper rollout, we can see a lot more people writing about and talking about this subject specific element of it. And to be honest, that's why I think, and I'm not just saying this because it is you two from UCL, but that's why I think that having this sort of face-to-face element of the ECF training is so important. Because, for example, I have six ECT groups, six, can you believe it? And two mentor groups, so a year one and a year two. I think that that's what's so important about those days, is that I have several people who might be doing history and they can chat about what they do in history and the implications for them. I have several people who might be doing PE and they can chat about, you know, what questioning and great formative assessment looks like in PE. And that is, for me, it's golden. It's invaluable.
So as a facilitator, then, is that something you'd advise, breaking down your group into subject specific groups so that they can then look at the interplay between generic pedagogy and subject-specific pedagogy? Because it's quite hard as a facilitator, because I know I'm an English teacher like yourself, and when I used to lead professional learning in school, when I was talking about maths, I always used to give the same ropey example, and then take me down to early years, and I've got nothing for you, other than ultimate respect.
But yeah, absolutely.
I have no examples, because it's just so far out my... knowledge, you know. No. So it's interesting. I'm interested in how you say you deal with that as a facilitator.
Yeah, so for example, we might talk about something in generic terms, and then I might ask them to reflect for a couple of minutes individually on what that means in their subject, and then I'll cold call perhaps and take some examples. And other, say I take a mathematician's example, and then I'd say, you know, Katie or whoever it might be, you're also a mathematician, can you build on that? Will you challenge it? Would you do it slightly differently? And I think quite a lot of the ECTs in my groups have said that they just find it really interesting as well to actually think about the implications for other subjects.
Of course, exactly right. You know, if you're a math teacher, just, you know, to caricature it a bit, if you're a math teacher and you might not think that group work is your thing, but sitting next to you is a drama teacher for whom group work is the bread and butter of what they do, and, you know, the opportunities to listen for 5 minutes to how a drama teacher organizes collaborative learning could be the difference that a math teacher really needs, and of course vice versa. I think there's a lot, so many advantages to sitting side by side with colleagues who teach it's particularly different subjects or different phases. That's so important. And that, another thing that you do, so just to pick you up on that a little bit, Hayley, because you said that you would often ask an ECT to quote an example from their own subject about what this might mean. Do you ever push back? Do you ever making sure that they're not just regurgitating some old nonsense they might have picked up from some, you know, some terrible teacher in the back of the room somewhere? How do you challenge them?
I think in a supportive way, but like a kind of a what if almost, you know, so, oh, that's really interesting. But what if, you know, and kind of positing it in that way, because I think, you know, even the ECF itself does talk about in Standard 8 being critical consumers of research. And I think that's really important. And I think what I've been really cheered to see actually both in ECF delivery and in MPQLTD delivery with a completely different provider is that actually that both have stressed that there isn't a one size fits all and that everything is contextual. And I think... MPQ especially has kind of quoted the Dylan William thing that everybody always quotes of, you know, and maybe Dylan William didn't even say it. He has a lot of misattributed quotes. But, you know, for example, not everything works everywhere, but something works somewhere. And I think that adage is something to live by, isn't it? Because as we all know, those of us who've been practicing teachers, you might do something with a class and think, I've cracked it, my goodness. And then next lesson, it's back to square one again.
Dylan William, everyone's most quotable academic.
Absolutely.
we need people like that. I think you've alluded to it already, Hayley, that the ECF generally and broadly across the country is not without its detractors.
Yes.
You and I are both aware that, you know, people on social media and elsewhere on the education press, sometimes quite prominent school leaders have talked about the extra burdens it's placed on their staff. Some of the criticism comes to the likes of us at UCL, you know, regarded as kind of big hitters and this kind of centralization of professional development. So I'm just really interested in your perspective on that. Where are you stand in all of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, I was a big supporter of the early career framework. I wrote a book about it, you know, and the reason why I was a big supporter of it was because I think we did need that consistency of approach across the country, because it was like a postcode lottery as to whether you got a decent mentor or not. And, you know, that can be the difference between somebody leaving after a year or somebody going on to have a positive impact on you know, thousands of lives as a teacher over a career. I thought it was much needed. I personally didn't see it as a straitjacket. I saw it as a scaffold for mentors and a way of mentors getting the status and the kind of elevated prominence that they deserved and have deserved for many, many years. That's kind of that key to teacher retention, really. So I'm very positive about it. Do I think I'm still positive about it? In many ways, yes. I think it does need adaptations and changes, like any whole scale rollout of a policy that's got to be a one size fits all for very, very different contexts. I think there probably could be more in there about collaborative learning, if I'm completely honest, about dialogue and oracy. I think there could be more in there that is more suited to a Key Stage 1 and EYFS model, because a lot of criticism it's received is that it's very secondary centric. Mm-hmm. And I can see how people might think that. Yeah. But I think that I'm still, you know, largely positive about the early career framework. What I do think, and I don't mind saying this to you on the podcast, that I had a conversation with the DfE not too long ago, where I was asked to give my feedback on the ECF. And I did say in that, and will say it very publicly, that I think more does need to be done about working in congruence with ITTE. For the ECF, because one of the criticisms that's come out is that it's a regurgitation of a lot that was learned at ITTE. And my perspective on that is that sometimes it is. But on the other hand, the other side to that is that as teachers, we wouldn't expect to do something once with our children and for them to get the grips of it. And for me, in the CCF and in ITTE, you should be watching an expert colleague doing things and discussing it and deconstructing it and practicing it. In the ECF, it's you doing it with a mentor, more as a guide on the side, would be my reading of it. So that is how I would counteract those criticisms. But I do see that there could be that element of challenge, I think, in the ECF for those really great ECTs who know all of that research, what's going to push them on.
I think it's interesting what you say about that, Hailey, because I read all the module completion forms, and if I had a pound for every time I read that, I'd be a millionaire. But I'm reading them less and less. But I wonder if it kind of links to what you sort of said about, you see the framework as a guidebook and not a rule book.
Yes.
And I think I notice a real correlation between people feeling that it's beneficial when they have that mindset towards it, that they realize that it's something that they've got to make work for them, and that's an active role. And I feel the same about teacher development. You know, we want ECTs to feel like they have an active role in shaping their own professional development and doing something different if they need to. So I think that kind of feeds into the idea of them feeling like it's a repeat, because although they might have an awareness of the research, they almost certainly should have an awareness of the research from their ITE year. What they won't have done, and what I feel I never did after 20 years of teaching, is be like, right, nailed that one. Every class I've got down. But I do agree with you on the other hand that there does need to be greater links between the ITE year and the ECF year, and there's something in our messaging around that as well. So I guess that teachers feel like it is part of a coherent journey.
Yeah, that's it. And it's gonna take a while. Like, you know, for many, many years they were completely disjointed, and now we're trying to do this kind of 3 years of continuous you know, golden thread. Doesn't say that phrase, but you know, it's absolutely true, isn't it, that, you know, this is what we're trying to do. It's this idea that it's a career long development that you're signing up for, and that first 3 years is a cohesive, joined up you know, way of being inducted into the profession. And yes, you may go on and develop your own pedagogic style, and absolutely I hope you do, where you might say, actually, a lot of that research I've just read might not work for me in this context. But what everybody then has are those strong foundations that they can build their own identity on, and that for me is why I support the ECF.
Yeah, I agree with you and what you said about it's almost a matter of entitlement, isn't it? Because, you know, you said previous to this, it could be seen as a bit of a postcode lottery as to whether you've got a good experience of early career teacher induction. And this is somewhat of a leveler and an entitlement to some, you know, the shared knowledge around teaching. But I totally agree with you as well in terms of we should be encouraging teachers to be critical of that research and not just passive receivers of it. I'd love to talk to you all day, but I know you're very busy, and I think that the school bell might be able to go in the minute. We give all our guests a post-it note. I'm going to pass you a beautiful red post-it note. And on it, could you tell me what you would write on it and where you would stick it, please?
Oh, wow.
Keep it clean.
A red post-it note.
Yeah.
What I would write on it and where I would stick it. Who is it for?
anyone. So you can decide really in terms of where you stick the post-it note, that would probably give us an indication of who's it for. So it could be on the bathroom mirror in a school, or it could be on the wall of the DfE, or it could be on Mark's desk.
Oh dear. Yeah. Now that's a temptation. I would probably stick it in a mentor's drawer when they went in to probably grab a snack in between the 5 minutes that they have to breathe in their day. And just say, keep going, you make a difference.
I think that's great. I think they'd really want to see that as well as they're having their snack. I think that'd be quite inspiring. So I think we're almost at the end.
Yeah, I think that we're going to set the dog off with the bell. Hayley, it's been a real pleasure to have shared half an hour with your time, of your time this afternoon. Good luck with your various endeavours, with your Irish Connect work, with your NPQ work, your ECF work, all of the stuff, your Mentoring Matters magazine. What have I left? Oh, yes. And the greater, ever more sales of your Mentoring in Schools book. it's definitely, we definitely heartily recommend it. Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming into the ECF staff room, and see you around sometime.
No, thank you. That was great. Really enjoyable. Thanks.
Our thanks go to Hayley Hughes, writer, expert on mentoring and facilitator on the UCL ECF programme, for sharing coffee with us this week in the ECF staff room.
Please do get in touch with us if you would like to talk about your ECF experience. We especially want to hear from a range of voices. And lastly, we hope you will join us next time for a biscuit and a chat with another colleague in the ECF staff room.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.